Welcome to another episode of The Corner Booth, the official podcast of RestaurantOwner.com. Today, the restaurant industry is changing faster than ever. Learn from successful independent restaurant operators and other industry leaders as they share best practices that will help you engage your team, delight your guests, and grow your business.
And welcome to another Corner Booth. Thank you for giving us some of your time today. I'm Chris Tripoli with RestaurantOwner.com. And if you like fajitas, and who doesn't? Really good fajitas. And if you like the convenience of delivery, then you're going to love being here today because we've got Pete Mora, who is the founder and is the president and director in charge of Fajita Pete's. So welcome. Welcome, Pete, to our program Corner Booth. Happy to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our listeners are very interested in people who are just willing to share experiences. And that's why I'm so glad that you were able to join us as a guest. You've got a great experience. You've got an interesting story. And I love our industry, the way we learn from each other. But before we jump into the details of the concept and things like that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you first got interested in the industry, what you did that maybe got you to this point?
I am from Colombia, originally, South America. I moved here in the very late 80s due to the issues we had in our country at that time. I was lucky enough to be one of the people that say, I'm not from Texas, but I got here as quick as I could. I arrived. I didn't know what a tortilla was. We have completely different cuisine than the Mexican cuisine, especially the Tex-Mex cuisine. But during those times, I grew up here. There was Ninfas starting out and big restaurants that really put Tex-Mex on the map. And I was lucky enough to acclimate my palate to those flavors. So I grew up in Houston, in the A-Leaf side of town. I went through the University of Houston, graduated with an entrepreneurship degree. And my goal, when we moved here, my parents always told me, we didn't bring you to the U.S. to fill out applications. We brought you here to do something for yourself. And you need to do it while you're young enough that you think you know everything, before you realize how dumb you are. So with that in mind, we started thinking, what are the industries that could let you know very quickly whether you're going to make it or not? Obviously, there was a little bit of the money issue. So we had to scrounge together all our nickels and figure out how to make up the rest. I was able to talk myself into a lease with a local landlord that was always very kind to me, Mr. Meyer. They were very nice to me. They gave me a lease when they probably shouldn't have. And they gave me 8 months to open the store. My father and I started making tables in our garage. Typical immigrant story. We walked uphill both ways to the Home Depot to get the wood. And after 8 months of painting, grouting, we scrounged together enough operating used equipment to open our first full service restaurant in Meyer Park. That restaurant was called Poblano's Mexican Grill. And we were there for 6 years. We made some cheesy quinceañera invitations, knocked on every door in the neighborhood, invited people to the grand opening, and we had a line out the door since November 4th, 2002. It was a blessing. It was a shock to the system to learn how to manage at that age staff, bussers, waiters, cooks.
Sure, sure. Yeah,
it was a big shock. So it was a good lesson for sure.
So Poblano's was the first restaurant. You did it with your dad. I'm imagining this was full service.
Yeah, with my dad and my mom and anybody else we could help get to help us. We had full service restaurant, full bar. It was, you know, the hole in the wall, mom and pop neighborhood Tex-Mex joint, where on Friday nights, all the neighbors would come. We'd have a little group playing music, and the kids would request the chicken dance, and they would dance on the dance floor and crowd it, make a crowd so our waiters couldn't get through it. But it was just a very cool experience. We got to meet, be really involved with the community and really get a sense for what we liked and didn't like about the restaurant industry.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that this was very successful for 6 years. So I guess the question is, did you decide to flip this into what you're doing today? Or how did you get to the point of deciding you wanted to do the fajita concept that you are
and to level up. Set, we're being very successful. We were able to pay our bills and survive. So that's the first step in entrepreneurship is figure out how to survive. It was good for our family. And like I said, the most important lesson there was the connections we made with the community. And the second year in business there, we really became intentional about developing another revenue stream for the business. So we started venturing into catering for oil companies.
Okay.
And pharmaceutical reps. At the time, there was a gap in the market where the big guys didn't want to cater anything that was under 40 people. They would make the reps go pick it up at their store and transport it. So, okay. Of course, I made the advertising catering 0 to 39 people. We deliver it to you, right? And then I would wait for people at the parking lot of these hospitals where they were coming out or going in full of bags. And I'd give them my card. I'd help them set up somebody else's food just to get the ride up the elevator with them and let them know who we were. We did a bunch of cheesy things. We had a Poblano's peso, a coin we gave out to reps where they could come in and cash it in for a free meal. And that's how we got into the catering world. And that really changed my perspective. Coming from the entrepreneurship program at the University of Houston, I wanted something to scale. But I never wanted to scale the full service model. I don't think if I had kept the full service model, I don't think I'd still be in the industry today. It was just very time consuming and difficult. And I didn't have the resources to have the infrastructure that I needed for the proper support. So with the catering menu, I realized that I didn't need 6,300 square feet to generate the revenue. And I was trying to increase my sales per square foot. And the quickest way is usually to get rid of as many numbers in the denominator as you can, right? When you want to make things look better. So once my lease was up and I couldn't negotiate a smaller space in that area, I shut down Poblano's, moved to a 1,200 square foot pizza kitchen that was about to go out of business. And I said, well, here we go. We're going to only sell fajitas because that's what traveled well. That's what we packed for our caterings. And then we made fajita derivatives out of it. Anything we could make, I could roll it up, call it a taco, put cheese on it, fold it, call it a quesadilla for you. But basically, it was fajitas. So then came the name Fajita Pete's. I wanted something simple that people knew what they were going to get when they were coming in. There was no question about what we offered. It allowed me, with a simple menu, to have a simple footprint, simple equipment package, and a smaller staff. So we started that in 2008. And thank God we were able to get it off the ground.
Well, it really does work. You know, that's true. Back in 2008, maybe we didn't realize then just how important the convenience of delivery was going to be. This was a good inconvenience then, but I imagine it's exploded since then. So you are adjusting because you saw the advantages of a smaller space, lower overhead. Mm-hmm. Less people needed, limited product needed, and let's make money by doing delivery and catering. So yes. What was the impact early on the margins?
It was amazing because you went to 1/5 of the square footage you needed.
Yeah, yeah.
And what better way to do sales per square foot than to sell stuff outside of your square feet, off premise, right? You use their square feet and you get the sales. So that was kind of my light bulb moment. I said, hey, that's the way to go. And with catering, you can plan for it. You can staff for it. You can, you get at least a 24-hour head start on it. So it's easier to manage your margins that way as well.
Yeah.
Now, I was still young and dumb, and I thought all I was going to do was cater and go home. Right. That was my initial intent with Fajita Pete's. I was going to open it from probably 8-2 in the afternoon and call it a day. And we were blessed enough that during the 3 weeks into my opening, a storm hit Houston, you know, those Houston storms that you get that shut down the city. And we were scared because our area where my restaurant was at lost power.
Oh, boy.
So we came through the floods, my cousin and I, and finally made it to the restaurant, realized that the power was still on and our hood worked. And I had just received our vendor order for the week. So I had a full cooler. And I said, if the power goes out, we're out of luck. You know, we lose everything in the cooler. I said, so let's cook it all and give it away. And that's really what started the other part of our business. Cousin and I started riding around in an unmarked white van because we hadn't logoed it yet. the neighborhood and knocking on doors that didn't have light. And we finally ran into a lady who was organizing a community cookout. And we said, hey, let us do the cooking today. Go to Fajita Pizza at 5:30. And of course, what the hell is Fajita Pizza? So we let her know we're next to Whole Foods. And wherever you see smoke coming out of the chimney, that's Fajita Pizza. And we didn't give any options. We had a pack for 3 people and a pack for 5 people. And we were just, I was able to get 2 cooks that have been with me since the beginning of my first restaurant to come in. And we cooked everything, packed it, and said, and we had a line. And we said, how many people in your family? 3. We'd hand them a bag. 5. We'd hand them 2 bags.
Oh, nice.
You know, and that was it. And we put a menu in there, and the power never went out in our store. So people kept coming in later to charge their phones during the week and the weeks after that to get ice from us. And it became kind of like a hangout, which then turned into, hey, my house is getting remodeled because it was flooded. Can you come deliver some food to my workers? And then that turned into the delivery aspect of it. And that turned into us opening from 11 to 8:30. And just from that little interaction with the community, it really helped open my eyes to another need that was in the area. Because at that time, like you said, 2008, people weren't even Ubering people, much less food. So it was just Chinese and pizza. So that's what I would tell people. I'd say Chinese pizza, fajita pizza. That was my way to get in their mind, right? And that's kind of how it took off from there.
That's wonderful. Well, I guess at this time I should let the listeners know too that for full disclosure, I'm a fan. Sometimes we're talking to people with concepts that we don't really know much about, but I have been eating your fajitas for, well, I don't know, probably a few years when I'm spending time in Austin. It's a favorite of my brother there and his family. And so we have been eating your product. But for those listeners might need to know now about the concept itself. We know how it got started now. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. I love that connection to the community. And then you're right. The community started seeing this as a place where I can go and I can pick up family packs.
Yep.
Why don't you describe a little bit about what Fajita Pete's is, menu, hours, how it works, maybe where you're located. I mean, because I know you're pretty big here.
Well, we started out in West University in Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. We're now have 30 locations open. We're in Austin, as you mentioned, Houston, Dallas. We're in Lubbock. We are in Kansas City. We're about to open Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Puerto Rico. So we're expanding and trying to spread the good Tex-Mex news to the people, one taco at a time. But the model was attractive because of the efficiencies in it, right? The small square footage, the simple equipment package. And I was lucky enough, about 7 years ago, I met my partner when I started really in earnest thinking about how to scale this thing. I met a guy named Joey, and he had kind of the same, he had a much more impressive background than me. He had developed concepts, grown concepts, his own concepts. And he came from CC's. That was one of the concepts that he helped and was a franchisee of. And they kind of have the same mentality of teachers, preachers, and coaches. That's who you market to. And so we kind of meshed that way. He had a lot more operational experience and negotiating experience. So we decided to say, hey, what about if we join our limited knowledge together and create a franchising arm of this company and try to offer it? And that's what we did. And that's kind of, that was when we started growing the franchising process. And we sold 10, we didn't know what the hell to do. So we put a sign on the door that says franchises available. And we sold 10 units off the bat. So that kind of got us a kickstart into franchising and really getting down our operations manual and stuff. But what was popular about the model is the simplicity. We would have people come in and just look. And you knew they were just scouting out the concept. And they would see people walk in, order, walk out with boxes of food. Because we do the onesies, twosies, but that's not our bread and butter. Our bread and butter in lunchtime is catering to corporate events. And then at nighttime, it's families of 4 or 5. So the ticket average is pretty good. But what really drew people's attention to us was our ticket average is around $65. And the transaction time is pretty quick. We have an app. We have all online ordering capabilities. A couple years after I met Joey, a family office came in and was interested for some god-awful reason of getting in the restaurant business. And they purchased half of the franchising company. And then helped us. Yeah, they came in and really, with their expertise in growing and scaling and money, they helped us really kind of punch above our weight on the training material we could get, the operations manual, the FEDs, all the processes and systems. And we work with them day to day, and they're very, I mean, of course, those people are very sharp, very, I mean, they have a lot of knowledge. They have insight into other industries that we can bring in to improve our company. But they've been working side by side with us for the last 5 years to really scale and improve the offering that we have.
Excellent. Okay, so there's a lot of points here that we're just going to have to kind of dig into. For you listeners, this means a concept built on simplicity, consistency is really ripe for expansion. And that makes sense. That makes great sense. Small size, less overhead, few people. And of course, the menu is very, very specific. I mean, it's beef, chicken, seafood, some combinations, a lot of family packs, but it isn't a wide variety. And again, I want to emphasize, this is all delivery and pickup. Do you do any counter service, any inside dining?
We have three little tables usually at our stores. Now our Pittsburgh store will have more just because of the way the alcohol laws are there. But the core concept here in Texas is 98% out the door.
Okay.
Now half of the orders come in through our app. Okay. And then the rest come in through phone-ins or walk-ins.
Yeah.
For lunch, people will come in and sit at one of the tables for a quick lunch. We do have a $9.99 menu just to give people something to munch on during their break. But we use that as an opportunity to market our corporate catering and really let them know, hey, if you can drive to your job, so can we. And take lunch to their whole office.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, and at night, it's just, if you can imagine just a pizza delivery place, but instead of pizza, we have fresh made delicious fajitas delivered to the customer's doors.
Well, and it makes sense that most of these are, I guess, larger packages. Most people are ordering this for the family in order to get that check average that you gave us moments ago. Mm-hmm. This isn't somebody just walking by and ordering, you know, one order for himself. Most of this must be
very rare. Most are fajitas for four. Most, you know, the most thing that's ordered is fajitas for four, small queso, extra tortillas, and maybe they'll throw in a quesadilla.
Now, there's a very good white queso. Who created that? There's a very good white queso.
Anything that's good, I take credit for. Anything that's bad is the new corporate team, okay? So that's how it is. No, they brought in, we have a corporate chef who's very talented. He's way too talented for us. But he wanted to learn more about the business aspect of it. Eddie, he's actually from Austin, but he's been able to come in and really improve some of our items and you know, make us better. Like we try, our motto is suck less every day, a little less every day. And he's helped us get to the next level on our training and anything culinary related for sure.
Well, I think everyone would agree that that's the best niche. If you're looking for a point of difference, if you're in a crowded niche, the best thing to do is be better. There's mm-hmm. always room for somebody who wants to be better. And I have to emphasize that sometimes because, you know, we meet a lot of people in the industry that feel like they're going to get, I guess, bigger, faster, or more profitable if they can just underprice, be the cheap guy. Everybody likes the cheap guy. And as I'm sure you would like to tell people, that's not really the case.
No.
If people don't really like your food, if they're not willing to pay for your food, they're not going to come back.
No, I tell people you can get cheaper fajitas, but then you got to eat them. You know, you still got to eat them. So you just got to be good at what you do, be fair. And it's all about the value proposition. You know, the prices, and it depends on the demographic you're trying to attract as well. We're in a demographic where the people have disposable income and they're willing to pay. They're not going to argue about $5 as long as you're meeting your promise to the guest. And that's something we tell the franchisees, don't make us liars. We say we have great food and great service. Don't make us liars. Do that part, you know, and it's about ticket times. It's about order accuracy. That's on top of the table stakes, which is a good product inside the containers that holds well, travels well, and it saves people the time. It gets people, the family gathered around the table again, and I'm not saying we're trying to make America great again, but we're trying to get people around the dining room table and create community, whether it's your family or any event that we cater.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the size, the simplicity. We talked a little bit about the menu. You talked about how you teamed up with some knowledgeable people from Joey, and then Joey brought in a team. They invested, they bought half of the franchise model. So those are a lot of really good points that listeners, you need to make a point of. What I'm hearing here is it's very important to know what you know. But as Pete learned, it's more important to really know what you don't know. And so he brought in people to surround himself with. And I guess that's what's launched this growth. Because that's
I've always been lucky enough to not know anything. So finding people that know what I don't know is easy because they're all over because I don't know much. So teaming up with those people, just finding the right people that you can trust. It's finding the right partner. And like one of them says that, you know, the most important thing about the partnership is the partner. And we've been blessed to get in, with a good group that's honest, that's willing to share. Because you'd be surprised. We interviewed other groups that they're very knowledgeable, but a lot of people hog the knowledge, which is weird. In the restaurant industry, we always preach to our managers, push down the knowledge, right? That's how you create efficiencies and service. But we were lucky enough to get with a team that is very open and very helpful to us.
It comes down to people. You know, it always does. It's the formula for success might have a lot of components, but the first one is people.
Yes.
Okay, so let's get back on the story. We know we started in 2008. We know we had some growth. Now what happens is you started growing in a variety of cities, different states. How do you find, how do you select your franchise partners?
And that's an important thing for somebody growing their brand, because I'm an operator. I mean, you can't see my video, but I'm in the storage closet right now as we do this interview. And we have a flaw that I've now talking to people who've developed brands. It's a very common flaw with people starting to grow, which is you think everybody can do what you do. You think if I did it, then this guy who's got this impressive business resume can do it too. And that's, we're finding out that that's not necessarily always the case. It's always comes down to people asking me when we do our observation days, when they're interested in the brand and they say, hey, does your model work? I say, yes, if you do.
Right.
If you work, the model works. If not, and it goes in one ear, not the other, but at least you have to tell them, right? There's the old saying, there's nothing better for the soil than the farmer's own 2 feet. And that's just how it is in the restaurant business. It's scalable. Once you get to a certain number, you can have an infrastructure of people that you like, that you groom in the way you want them to treat people, that can deliver on the promise to the guests. But that takes time, and it's not a shortcut. It's a lot of people getting they fall in love with the romanticism of entrepreneurship, and everybody forgets that when they see an entrepreneur that has gray hair on their beard like me, that you don't start at chapter 30. You always have to start at chapter one, and you have to build it, and you have to feel it. You have to understand it. And that process is very important. And it's crucial that you understand that, and you let your potential franchisees know that and hope they understand it so that you can save yourself and them a lot of headaches along the way.
I would say so. So do you prefer to have that hands-on franchisee that's going to have one or two stores and work there? Or do you prefer doing what I know a lot of people look for, and that's that multi-unit development agreement where someone buys a city and they have to go in and do 12 or something?
I think at first we were going for that, and we were lucky enough to find it. But our brand is small, and it's still kind of it's a niche within a niche, right? We have catering in the morning, service at night, and you have to have the time and the time commitment to be able to explain that, to educate your market. And you can educate it through media, through all the vehicles you have available to you. But the best way to do it is one taco at a time. So I do think that for the next round of growth, I would go towards 1-2 unit operators, Okay. And now if you have five and you have the we have a franchisee that's great here in town, Jason Middleton in Houston. He's got five stores looking for his six, and he's got the team down. But he's got those people that are the operators in each of his units, right? So it does work. You just have to come at it the right way and understand your path to profitability based on the goals that you have.
And how, when you are in that selection process and you feel like they're compatible with that plan and they're going to be able to provide the work, and then once they get in, how does the process go? Do they have to go to a particular unit for a certain amount of training, or do you have the training down where it's more modulized and can go out in the field?
We do have a couple of certified training locations that they go to. We have an online training program called Wisetail. So my corporate team is comprised of Patty Brown. She's our director of training. We have Bruce Foster, who's our franchise business consultant. We have Eddie, who's our chef. He goes, trains people. We have Gracie, and we have Elsa. And between all of us, well, really most of them now, they go and check on stores, help stores, and train people when they need it. They do compliance work as well for brand standards and typical things like that. But we really try to not be auditors. We try to be just somebody to help you, because we're all on the same side. They want to make money. They want to be efficient. They want to provide great food. So it's a constant journey. It really is, because you have new employees coming in. You're developing new markets. So we have that's kind of how we break down our team. I explained the corporate structure so you know. Patty's in charge of Wisetail. She's in charge of the training department, and she's done a great job of developing the modular type of training that you mentioned, where you can certify somebody online. It's got enterprise level, the ability to be able to check. A manager can see where his new hire is in the training process. He finishes modules, certifies at a station. So we have all those little bells and whistles that are crucial in maintaining consistency for a brand.
That's great. And again, for as many franchisees that you have out there, because with the variety of cities and multiple states, to have, say, a 5-member team doesn't sound too heavy. And that's good. I don't think people need to build too much corporate anymore. You know, with the use of technology and the kind of support that you can do online, we don't necessarily need as many people running around like in the old days.
And we have Joey that oversees the operations. We have Hugh Will, who's one of the partners, and he oversees the marketing department. We have Baker Tilney, who's our CFO, in essence. And so between all of us, we try to find the right answer.
Well, marketing was the next thing I wanted to talk about. Since we now know that what we're operating here are corporate stores, how many stores do you operate as a corporation? Then how many
are? No. We operate one corporate store.
That's it. Okay.
And then the rest is franchise. Yeah. And Hugh has a guy named Mark underneath him who does all our marketing. Marketing is an interesting thing. I'll let you ask me what you were going to ask me, because that's an interesting journey for a young brand as well.
That's exactly what I wanted to know, is marketing, promotion, how it grows from the early brand to the bigger brand, and then how you educate and support to market your brand, but when you're doing it through a sea of franchisees.
Yeah, so when we teamed up with the family office, it was really about a change in how it looked, and really conveying what we are through our logo, through our brand image and brand standards. So we re-logoed. We have, you can't see a video, but we have a little scooter guy with a sombrero. Our branding was created. We had goals of what we wanted it to look like. Corporate created a lot of the templates for marketing with the same feel, fonts, colors. So it all matched. It's very cohesive. And for the first two and a half years, we developed that. We did the social media. We did the pretty advertisings. We did all the cosmetic work that a brand needs. Right. Now, in the last year, we've brought it in-house.
Okay.
And Mark is a really analytical guy, and he can tell you what's working and what's not working. With technology, we can track people through the ordering process, through the customer journey. When they visit us, we can see where they're visiting from. And he's been very good at that. And that work is key in really seeing what you want to focus on, what you can pull the lever on, and what's not working. Because really, the reason people buy franchises is not because I'm a fajita savant. It's because I've already messed up a million ways. And all you're buying is the right to not mess up the same ways we did. So it saves you all the money, right? You're buying all the lessons. And that's kind of what we're doing through our marketing department as well, is learning what works and what doesn't. And as an operator, I always say, look, you can have a beautiful, beautiful sculpture in your restaurant, and if the food and the service is not good, nobody's going to care.
Right.
It's all about execution at the end of the day. And we found that the more people that taste fajita pizza like fajita pizza and come back to fajita pizza. So it really becomes, and with a limited budget of a small brand, you have to hunt with a rifle. So you have to be very peculiar and use your ammo wisely.
So does the marketing then that you guys do in-house and that you provide and direct to the franchisees, is that something that is just a part of the arrangement, or is that, like in many cases, something that's paid for extra, where the franchisees pay a marketing fee kind of a thing?
They do. They pay 1% of sales. That's it. We encourage them to use an additional 2% on very local area marketing. Okay.
Yeah.
Local store marketing is crucial. And by local, I mean a mile and a half to 2 miles. If you can get those people, you're gonna be fine. So that's how we break it down. Because I can't, even within Houston, I can't manage for my Woodland franchisee his marketing as good as he can.
Sure.
You know, and the 1%, quite frankly, doesn't cover the basis that you need for a corporation. It doesn't cover the web maintenance, the photo shoots, the development, the social media. But we'd rather, instead of charging more, we'd rather them spend it at local, use ours, our already created material, leverage it with local flavor and saturate their community with fajita pizza.
Exactly. I think you made a good point there, where most of the people that are attracted to being a franchisee are people who like the industry, obviously, but they're sort of hedging their bets. What they know that they're paying for is knowledge, experience, established systems, basically, so that they don't have to test it themselves, stumble, and have to learn from their mistakes.
And the buying power, right? Like, I can't, you know, when you're street buying, when you're a street buyer, the providers never tell you you're a street buyer, but I mean, you're paying a lot more per pound on certain items. You're paying more in fees. So it allows you buying power that you wouldn't be able to get by yourself as well.
And can we talk a little bit about that? Let's talk about product procurement. As people do their franchising, I know you have to provide them with the specs of things that they absolutely have to buy in order to, you know, have your brand.
Yes, sir.
But are there things that you do and then supply to them? Sauces, marinades, dressings?
No. We didn't want to get in the commissary business because this business is hard enough with us adding another layer of revenue to corporate that takes from revenue at the store level. So what we did is we went out. At first, I used to marinate and make everything in-house at the shops that I operated at the time. As we started growing, we wanted to keep that. But in visiting some stores, we realized that sometimes people use sugar instead of salt when they're making a recipe. And sometimes they're watching Facebook while they're at work and not really paying attention to the recipe card. So what we did was, when we got to an appropriate volume, we went to a central distributor who makes our marinades. Again, with our simple menu, there's core items that we can control to control consistency. So we have our meats marinated by American Meats. They have a big plant in Dallas, Fort Worth, and one in California. The Day family, they're super nice, very welcoming to a small brand like us, and they do all our marination, and then they distribute it to our broadline distributor. Our broadline really picks up from them, and then from there we go to every store. So that's kind of how, that's the model for everything we do to control consistency and to help with costs.
Exactly. And it does both. In addition to the marinades, are there other key items? I mean, particular sauces, seasoning mixes?
We haven't gotten to the point where we have our seasonings in packages yet. I mean, we make, all right, so all the only thing we make is guacamole pico.
Right.
We shred lettuce. We shred cheese. We make salsa. But even that, we can buy our salsa already made through our distributors.
Yeah.
The queso, we can buy already made, our recipe. We do like to make tortillas in-house. Now, we do have some franchisees that use the our recipe tortilla that's delivered to them through a third-party vendor. We don't make those. But, you know, the best tortilla is the one you're making in-house. So most of our franchisees opt for that.
Okay.
So other than that, I mean, there's really not much that we need to control our product, our integrity.
No, and that's, again, it goes back to the advantage of having a very simple, very well-directed menu. You've got, you know, five or six very key items that need to be developed in order to maintain the brand's consistency, and you went to a commercial kitchen to do that early on. Mm-hmm. So that sounds wonderful. So you're right. Not only does it help you with consistency, but also bulk purchasing.
Yep.
So the franchisees can have much, you know, lower cost. How has your brand weathered the curveballs that the industry had? You know, it's impossible to talk to people without having to talk about, you know, the horrible speed bump we had to clear with COVID, changing in the rules, the shutdown, and what that did. And then coming out of that, what happened with things like supply cost, today's labor market. How have you weathered those storms?
Well, in the industry, I know before we started filming, we were talking about ups and downs of the industry. And I wasn't aware that there were any ups. So dealing with the downs is a little easier, right? So COVID, we were set up for COVID, and we actually sold 100 units during COVID. That we just started franchising right before COVID happened. And the fact that we were set up with curbside, with the app, with 90-something percent to go, really helped us during that time. But that was, you know, it's just something that happened and we were ready for it. As far as the supply chain issues that came after, those were very difficult to deal with, because the flip side is that we were a to-go company ready for COVID. After COVID, everybody thought they were a to-go company and started buying to-go packaging. Top that off with, combine that with the fact that factories are closing. There's nobody making it. The boats are stuck somewhere in the sea. I don't know whose fault it was, but it was just, you couldn't get any product. So those, right, that increase in pricing, I mean, you have to take price increases to deal with it. We were late on the first round, and then we've been good after that on really keeping up to the minute costing on our items. Because for us as a to-go company, it's not just food cost, labor cost, which is the heartbeat of every business, right?
Sure.
For me, food cost is the packaging that goes in it.
I would think that's so. Part of the meal.
Yeah.
I would think so. And for some of the listeners that are out there, sometimes remember, when you're looking at that standard chart of accounts, typically paper and packaging isn't operating expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, however, you're in quick service where paper packaging is a part of every recipe. So that's why I could think that I could see where a franchisee would probably want to have paper and packaging as a part of cost of goods in this case.
Of course, because people use it as an advantage to say, hey, my cost of goods is only 26%. Fajita pizza is 31.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but I got whatever caused me to put in the bag your order, that's what I'm going to put in the cost of goods. It's going to be the packaging, the chemical, everything goes in there. So, because I guess that's just the operator in me. Maybe I should market it a little different. But whatever it costs you to get the order out the door is what you should list there.
Sure. Sure, sure, sure. And then, of course, for a unit now, keeping up with the app, keeping up with the packaging, doing the commercial delivery, about how many staff members does it take to operate a busy Fajita Pete's?
A busy one, you need about 5 in the kitchen when you're humming, the busiest time. 5 in the kitchen and 3 to 4 up front. That's it. And that's for a store. I'm talking about a store that's doing... Remember, we have modest sales numbers here. Our goal is to keep our opening expenses low and our sales to be right around 15,000 a store. Now, we have the gamut. As new stores that do 12, we have stores that do 30 a week, and we have stores that do 50 a week. So it's just really based, everything's based on projections in our model. We have all the charts you could ask for. As far as when you're ordering your food truck, you just have to put projections and it'll tell you how much of each item to order. It'll tell you how much you should prep every day based on the projection. So the simplicity, the tools that we have on hand really allow you to minimize labor and maximize output. the high ticket averages help with that, remember?
I would think so. Yeah. Because, I mean, even with, as we all know, product costs going crazy, the idea of having a good margin, and you'll get a better margin if you're selling higher ticket items. So, yeah, I think you mentioned before, I guess the most popular item was like a family pack for four people. Yeah, I can see that as the sweet spot. You know, you if you're busy during the week, mom and dad are working, it's just too convenient to call and get a delivery or call and go do a pickup. You've got a couple of kids at home. It's a perfect family meal.
Yes. No, I think that, and people, you know, if you have three, you don't mind having a little leftover. I tell people to top it up, put an egg on it the next day and make yourself some breakfast, you know. But and when I talk to groups of restaurant people that are starting, I say that we have all these things in fajita pizza. We've been blessed to have access and in the people that know about these things, to have all these tools and all these benefits of the years of knowledge. And it's still hard. That's what people have to understand. This is, it's still difficult. It's simple, but simple does not mean easy.
And there you
go. It comes down to people. It always comes down to people. Store success is based on the manager of that store. The leadership within a store, within those four walls, is going to dictate the success of that store. So I don't, because you know, we get to talking about what we have, what we've done, where we're going, and it sounds like it's all roses and rainbows, but it's hard. Every day is, and you're only as good as your last meal in this industry. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a serving heart to be in it. So don't let anybody blow smoke. This is work.
Well, there's a couple of really good key points you just made that I want to underline. And that is, this is a simple concept. And I know that people are drawn to the fact of wanting to get into the business if they can do something that is simple, less products to manage, fewer people to supervise. I get it. But I like what you said. Simple doesn't mean easy. It is a daily challenge, isn't it? And it is some units are going to do better than others, all because of the way their leader manages.
Yes.
How do you handle a franchisee when you think that that manager isn't necessarily handling things correctly? They're off track. They are maybe inconsistent with their serving times or poor quality, bad, you know, complaints. Is this something that as the franchisor, you can jump in and say, penalty flag here, we need to talk?
Yeah. What do you through the audits and the tools that we have a very cool tool called Ovation. That is, when people leave, they get a little survey and it's got an angry red face and a happy heart face, hard eyes face. And the guests can click on one and tell you what they thought of their experience. Those we have insight into for each store. When it's a bad experience, it goes straight to the store manager immediately. Mm-hmm. So if you, Mr. Tripoli, go pick up at my store and you say, Pete, he forgot the salsa. Maybe he needs to stop rambling so much and check the orders. So I'll get a message that says, I forgot the salsa. And then we can then identify which order number it was, call that customer and say, hey, I'm so sorry for the mistake. Own it. This is all basic above the line management stuff that you learn. Own it, fix it, and you know, give a discount on the next one. We believe in 150% off at my store. You get that one free and the next one half off just so we can earn the trust again. Because we're not selling fajitas, we're selling trust. And, you know, they just take the form of fajitas.
I like that. Three steps. Own it, fix it, and then, you know, reward them for the next, you know, purchase. Yep. That works. So by doing that, you're actually taking what is a guess negative. And rather than a simple apology, seems like you're turning it into a marketing opportunity, because if they know that they got it credited, they know they got a sincere apology. And now the next one, they're invited to order again and get half off.
Yeah, some of the best guests that I have were the ones that were the most at one point, because I dropped the ball on something. But if people realize that you care, it changes. That's all they want to know, is that you care. You know, I told my operations manual writer, Mr. Kevin Hogan, I'm sure you've run into him in your world, and he is amazing at franchising, franchise sales, and franchise development. And he could have saved me so many sheets of paper if the second line in our operation manual is care. Because if you don't care, stop reading. Nothing's going to matter. It could be the most beautiful crafted Shakespearean work of art of an operations manual. But if you don't care to read it and do what it says, stop reading.
Good point. Very good point. These are all good points. Anybody that is operating a restaurant and feels like growth through franchising might be their next step, I think is really, really getting excellent input from everything that you're saying. So just to talk about how big this has gotten and what kind of, you've got well over 100 operating units already?
No. We have 30 operating and 100 awarded.
Okay, 100 in the works. Wow.
Yeah. We have 30 operating.
And you are in not just Texas now, but Kansas, soon to be Chicago, yeah. Illinois, and where the heck else?
We're going to do Puerto Rico beginning of next year.
Okay. So you're going to be in
We have one in Denver as well, yeah.
Excellent.
So we're going to be in Puerto Rico beginning of next year. That's going to be an interesting challenge. But I'm looking forward to it. I think we got the right franchisees in the right places, and we're going to give it our best shot to spread Tex-Mex all over U.S. Like, you know, we're in Texas, so we believe that going out of the state, we're already international.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Let me just ask you what kind of a short-term strategy, if international works, does that mean that you're searching for maybe other established operators in other countries that might accept this brand and bring it to them?
Right now, with the way the economy is and the uncertainty in the markets, we have decided to... We've been blessed that we've never done outreach for franchising. It's always come into us, right? Mm-hmm. So we take inbound calls, and we're going to continue that right now. We're going to focus on improving the stores that we have, and my ideal growth would be through existing franchisees.
Yeah, that's good.
I think it's not about the 100th store. It's about the next one being great, and it's about the one after that and all of them. So less, but better.
Yeah, that's a great model. No, it really is. That's a good model. And that model fits in with some, say, very, very well-established companies that people probably know at and hit their drive-through windows daily. Mm-hmm. And they have been able to sustain success for years. And part of that was that they felt like the better they support their franchisees, the better those franchisees will grow. Yeah. And the better those franchisees grow, the fewer new franchisees you got to go advertise and go chase. So you can build a brand by doing that. Well, that sounds wonderful. And I wish you the best with doing it. 30-some operating stores, 100 in the process. I love your commitment to community and the way you talked about your community marketing, that little 2-mile circle. If operations operates and the guests love you, that seems to be the best marketing. That's the way you're operating. So everybody that was listening today, I hope you made notes of this. These are really some good pearls of wisdom. Every independent operator that I meet, typically within the conversation, something about growth, mm-hmm. how to do it right, how to find people to do it right. What should I do first, second, or third? Always comes up in a conversation. And so these points that you hit so wisely, Pete, are exactly what most independent operators are thinking about.
Yeah. And that's another thing I want to do when I'm even older than now, is just help mom and pops really be careful about the next step. And, I've managed to get into very little bit of commercial real estate through my restaurants. So I think anything that we can do to help the single unit operators, the small brands, solidify them and their financial future for their family through real estate or any aspect of business is something we should share within the community. Because at the end of the day, people ask you, hey, do you worry that such and such is opening down the street? No, the sun shines for everybody. There's different people have different target markets. And we really just need to make sure that we all make it through these tough times, because we are the local neighborhood restaurants. We are on the list of the local neighbors, and we want them to continue to have those options and be serviced by people who are involved in their communities directly.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Everybody, you've been listening to Pete Mora, the founder and CEO of Fajita Pete's. If there isn't one in your neighborhood, it sounds like to me one will be coming quickly, but look them up and go check them out. Pete, thanks again for taking your time. We really appreciate it. And everybody, we hope we connect real soon on another Corner Booth. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Corner Booth. We'll be back next Tuesday with more inspiration, insights, and industry best practices to help you engage your team, delight your guests, and grow your business.